4th of July deals are on at Lowe's. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances, including the Samsung Bespoke French Door Refrigerator, featuring Beverage Center and Dual Ice Maker. Plus, when you buy more, you save more. Now's the perfect time to upgrade your home with top Samsung appliances and hot 4th of July savings at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.
Las Vegas. It's so much more than just a city.
It's a feeling. It's that feeling of excitement when you spot the lights of the Strip out the airplane window.
It's that feeling of awe as you stroll down the boulevard, taking in the sights and sounds.
And it's that feeling of satisfaction, knowing that you're in the greatest city in the world.
Tens of millions of people share that feeling every year.
And I'm just one of them, here to take you to the world-famous Vegas Strip
and beyond.
My name is Jeff, and this is Jeff Does Vegas. Welcome to episode number 176 of Jeff Does Vegas. Before we get rolling for this episode of the podcast, I want to thank my guest from the last episode, Jeff Schumacher, Vice President of Exhibits and Programs at the Mob Museum in downtown Las Vegas. Jeff was back for another conversation about Las Vegas history, this time to talk about the infamous Black Book, officially known as Nevada's List of Excluded Persons. This is the list of people who are prohibited from entering gaming establishments in the state of Nevada. Jeff and I discussed what led to the creation of the Black Book back in 1960, what leads to a person being placed on the list, some of the famous names found in the Black Book, and much more. If you haven't listened as of yet, jump into the archives at jeffdoesvegas.com or search out episode number 175, Blacklisted, The History of the Nevada Black Book. It's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you listen to podcasts. We have officially reached the end of an era in Las Vegas. After 67 years, one of the most legendary properties on the Strip is shutting down, and as of April 2nd, 2024, the Tropicana will be no more. When it originally opened back in April of 1957, the property was one of the most luxurious hotels and resorts in Las Vegas, calling itself the Tiffany of the Strip. It's seen growth and expansion over the decades, and it's survived ownership changes, financial problems, and a global pandemic, all to be permanently closed to make way for a new Major League Baseball stadium. Joining me for this episode of the podcast to talk about the history of the Tropicana is UNLV professor and Vegas historian David G. Schwartz. David and I went in-depth on the Tropicana's past, including the people behind the conception of the property, what set it apart from other resorts on the Strip at the time, the infamous figures associated with running the Tropicana, and much more. We even shared a few fun facts about the Tropicana that you might not know about. Please enjoy my conversation with David G. Schwartz.
The Tropicana's been on the Strip since 1957, so it's been a fixture for so long, but it looks like it's going to be over soon.
And it's kind of weird. I was doing a little bit of research into the Tropicana before we sat down, and this was something I didn't realize. Vegas has almost kind of come full circle with the opening of the Fountain Blue last year and the closing of the Tropicana this year. I didn't realize there's kind of a weird sort of Fountain Blue Tropicana connection that goes all the way back to the beginning.
Yeah, it is interesting. It is really interesting. So it was a guy named Ben Jaffe, who was a shareholder at the Fountain Blue, also opened, you know, was part of the team that opened the Tropicana. So that's a connection right there. So that is there.
The very, very early days of the Tropicana, April 4th, 1957 was the opening day. And Vegas was kind of going through a bit of a boom at that period. There had been several properties that had sort of opened in the 5 years leading up to the opening of the Tropicana.
Yeah, there had been. You know, in 1955, there was six properties opened. All of them went bankrupt. All of them changed owners. So that was a little bit of a shock for folks in Vegas. And they started a transition to convention business. They started to build the convention center, which would eventually opened in 1959. So they were maybe a little bit cautious coming in with this. So the Tropicana was going to be a little bit different from what had come before it.
They did do some different things. What did they do to sort of separate themselves from some of those other properties that had opened up along the strip?
One thing they wanted to do was to be a little bit more luxurious. You know, basically the Tropicana cost about $15 million to build in 1957. The Riviera, which was 9 stories high, the first high rise on the strip, was only $8.5 million, and that was 2 years earlier. So it's interesting that that happened. Also, it was even more expensive than the Fontainebleau in Miami, which had twice as many rooms as the Tropicana. So clearly they wanted to build something that was different, you know, not bigger, which is the way a lot of casinos were going, were getting bigger. This was not going to be the biggest.
Yeah, that sort of seemed to be their plan. They marketed themselves, was it as the Tiffany of Las Vegas, and they sort of tried to create this, as you say, this sort of very luxurious image and bring something different to Vegas.
Yeah. And there was a little bit of tension around that. Some people said, well, no, Las Vegas is howdy podner and cowboy stuff, you know, not luxury. Some people were, and, you know, we want you to be able to wear your cowboy hat inside, and people might not feel comfortable. But basically, the idea was to do something a little bit more upscale.
And of course, the inevitable mob connections were there with the Tropicana. There were some very, very early connections right from the start, but they kind of made an effort to sort of bury those connections, didn't they?
They did. So Phil Castle, Dandy Phil Castle, was one of the folks who was involved with building it. He was really kind of the guiding inspiration behind it. And he was actually a partner with Frank Costello in a New Orleans casino that was illegal, and had been friends with Costello for a really long time. So one of Costello's best friends, so to speak, was going to be an owner. Also, Ben Jaffe owned a hotel in Miami Beach. That means that Meyer Lansky is probably involved one way or another. So really, you kind of have everything coming together there. And they denied, oh, there's no links with Costello, but he's friends with Castle, and Castle is part of the casino. So most people would say that there was a link.
Well, and they did kind of almost discover by accident that Frank Costello link as well. I mean, Frank Costello, obviously organized crime, he's kind of got a bit of a target on his back, and he got involved in essentially an attempted murder that sort of, this was the catalyst to them saying, hey, we know that you're a part of this.
Yeah, this is really a fascinating story. So Frank Costello is out. Maybe he was listening to Frank Sinatra while he's having dinner in New York, in Manhattan. And he gets back to the lobby of his apartment building. Somebody shoots him in the head. Now, and he falls to the ground. He's bleeding. It is just a flesh wound. It just kind of grazed his scalp. So a lot of blood, not a lot of damage. But when he's in the hospital, the police officers go through his clothes and they find a piece of paper that basically has the total casino wins and then how much money was going to different people, Mike, Jake, L, and H. So it's fascinating because they found out, like, hey, you know what? In that first month that it was open, this is exactly what the Tropicana made. So how does this mob boss in New York have this piece of paper with the Tropicana's win numbers on it? My God, how could that happen? It must be magic. Maybe he's got a fortune teller or something like that. So this was really, you know, that was where the story really came out into the public.
And those organized crime connections really did continue for quite some time with the Tropicana. It was almost sort of one of the last mobbed up properties on the strip. And as I say, that carried right through into the later years. Joe Augusto was a guy that was quite heavily involved, and they sort of, again, it's the fun part of the backstories of some of these properties. They did some fudging to make him a part of this casino and make it look legit.
Yeah. So, and they did that. They brought him in and basically said, oh, he's in food and beverage. He's in entertainment. He's the director of entertainment. You know, he's not doing anything with the casino, but he's also tied with the Kansas City mob. and basically is kind of running the casino for a while. Although he's not supposed to be, he is.
The other thing that I found quite interesting with him was he was quite heavily involved in the Follies show. That was that was his baby almost.
Yeah, he's the one who brought it in with Lou Walters. So that's kind of interesting. There really is kind of some, the ownership of the casino really did go through some interesting twists and turns over the years, for sure.
Looking into the Tropicana with the organized crime connection and how deep it actually ran, was that it doesn't seem to get the same type of attention as, say, the Flamingo or the Stardust. And it just sort of, it's not as big in pop culture. I mean, you could almost, based on some of the stories that I read with the Tropicana, you could almost make a movie about the story of the Tropicana, but it doesn't seem to be there. Why do you think that is? Why do you think it doesn't get the same level of attention?
It's hard to say. I mean, obviously with Casino, you had Scorsese, you know, and, you know, you really can't beat that. You know, if you're going to tell that kind of story, it's hard to find somebody better to do it. But Tropicana, I guess, maybe didn't quite have the publicity that they did, you know, for the Stardust stuff. You know, also maybe it wasn't quite as clear a story because there were some twists and turns in there. So that might be it too. But I agree, it is a fascinating tale.
One of the other fascinating stories that I really found in there was the story of Mitzi Stauffer Briggs, the heir to the Stauffer Chemical fortune, which sounds like something out of a Seinfeld episode to me. It doesn't sound like a real thing, but she really, it was just this weird story of ownership with her.
Yeah. And there were a lot of folks in Vegas in the 70s, I guess, you know, throughout history, people who didn't really have a background in gambling, but somehow said, you know what, I'm going to invest in a Las Vegas casino. And a lot of them lost their money. And, you know, was it because they had bad business decisions or was it because people were skimming? You know, you be the judge for that. You know, basically, so she buys into the Tropicana in 1975. She then, 2 years later, gets a majority ownership in it. And Tropicana was moving forward. They built I forget if it was the Tiffany or the Paradise Tower, but they built their first tower in 1979. Basically added a lot of rooms, added some casino stuff. That's when the stained glass ceiling came into the casino. So they did that. So Briggs is putting money in the casino. She's basically doesn't know the business, so she can only trust her advisors, and Agosto was one of those advisors. You know, meanwhile, there is a skimming operation going on where they're skimming money and sending it back to Kansas City. Again, this is familiar to anyone who's seen Casino, very similar thing. Then all of a sudden, the FBI, 1979, on Valentine's Day of all things, FBI raids the Tropicana. They had found out about this because of, if anyone has seen Casino, and I'm assuming if they're listening to your podcast, they probably have a familiarity with it. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the part where they're in the grocery back there in Kansas City and they're talking about stuff. That actually happened. That was Operation Strawman. And that was how they found out about what was going on at the Tropicana. So basically, feds raid. Agosto turns state's evidence. Carl Thomas, who was the manager of the casino, is convicted of skimming, testifies, but then gets out of prison early. And he then mysteriously dies in a single car accident on a deserted road in Oregon. Yeah. Funny how that happened.
Weird, eh?
That happened. And the kind of the sad part of it, and there really is, and I know Casino was a Greek tragedy around Ace Rothstein, Lefty Rosenthal. I know, and again, Scorsese, great filmmaker, set up wonderfully. But it seems like there's an element of tragedy here, too. Briggs just trusted people. She didn't go to prison. Even when they were testifying about her, they basically said, yeah, she didn't know anything, but she lost all her money. And she ended up working at the Carving Cart restaurant as a hostess on the Strip. So after being this wealthy heiress, went to that and apparently had kept a very positive attitude for the rest of her life.
It was really interesting kind of digging into her life because, as you say, she really didn't seem to she didn't know what was going on, and the property really didn't do all that badly under her ownership, per se. As you say, I mean, there was expansion and there was growth, and really it does seem like, as you say, just sort of this tragedy for her.
Yeah. And again, you can't skim money if the casino's losing money. So they did, you know, they wanted it to do well, just they were skimming money.
As we move into the early 2000s, I mean, the casino, obviously, the Tropicana did well through the 80s. Again, there was more growth, there was more expansion. And then into the early 2000s, they had lots of huge plans for this property. I mean, they, including as far as there was talk at one point, if I was reading correctly, talk of actually demolishing the property and building a new Tropicana in that spot. But none of those really big plans ever really came to fruition.
Yeah, and a lot of this is because the ownership changed again. So Ramada bought in to the company that operated, and there was a difference between the real estate and the operating company. They bought in the operating company, and basically that happened in 1979. So they bought in. And that changed a lot of things because now you had corporate ownership. They're also part of a huge hotel chain, so really big name recognition. Kept the name Tropicana. Started building a Tropicana casino in Atlantic City, which caused them some trouble. And it's really interesting because they started to shift, like a lot of Vegas shifted in the early 80s, from the upscale, from Baccarat to basically quarter slot machines. And this is where the Tropicana really did that. So basically, before it had been the Tiffany of the Strip, they'd had this big luxury emphasis, again, with the stained glass in the ceiling and everything. And then about a year later, they're like, yeah, we're going to start a bus program to bus people in from LA and Phoenix and places like that. So it's kind of interesting, although that was what was happening. You know, they then in 84 add a new tower, and they really go for this shift to an island theme, which is really fascinating because it's Las Vegas, which is the middle of a desert. It's interesting, too, because it's ahead of its time, because what's Mirage going to do in 1989? Tropical Paradise, South Seas Paradise, and people take it absolutely seriously. When Tropicana does it in the mid-80s, it seems kind of cheesy, like, oh, all right. So it's very interesting, the difference, how the same idea can be executed so differently.
Right.
Where if you have a Steve Wynn doing it versus a Ramada. So that's kind of that, which I find that to be, I don't want to say it's my favorite period of the casino, but it has a certain charm that you don't really see before or after.
How much did the economy play into that sort of failure to expand through those early 2000s? I mean, that was a weird time in Vegas. There were some other stalled projects. I mean, the Echelon Place, which of course eventually became Resorts World, Fountain Blue, both of those projects sat empty and vacant and three quarters or half finished sort of through that whole same period. Was it something similar with the Tropicana? Was it just, hey, you know what? The economy's terrible. We don't want to move forward on this.
Well, it's interesting because the Tropicana in some ways is a lot like the Sands, where they had an established name, you know, or even later on the Riviera, although Riviera is a bad example. I'll tell you why in a minute. So basically, you know, with the Sands, they had series of new owners starting around 1980, 81, and like, hey, we're going to buy into this. We're going to double the size. The economy's crashing in the early 80s. Can't do it yet. Okay, now we have a new owner, but we missed that window in the late 80s, so we can't do it. Now it's the 90s. There's too much competition. And then by the time it's 1996, well, we might as well just tear it down and build a new one. So they kind of missed that window where they could have expanded, but the way Riviera did, where they gradually expanded it. Okay, we'll add another 500 rooms. We'll add another 500 rooms here. Both Tropicana, although they did expand, and the Sands missed that in the 90s. So it's interesting. Sands gets bought and demolished to make way for Venetian and Palazzo. Tropicana still holds on because it was still making enough money that it was profitable. And the idea always was, this is a real estate play. If you remember back in Vegas in the early 2000s, everybody wanted to sound smart and say, well, this is a real estate play, doing all this, and the days of the MGM land bank where they're buying all land and everything. So it was around that size, that time. And the idea was, yeah, this has a lot of potential to be redeveloped.
It's interesting you mentioned about the whole idea with the Ramada buying in and doing the whole, we're going to own the hotel or run the hotel, but not own the land under the hotel. Those deals are still in play today in Las Vegas, which is kind of interesting when you've got groups that are saying, well, we're going to buy the property that Caesar's Palace sits on, but we're going to let Caesar's Resorts run the property. It's interesting that that was going on back then. This isn't some sort of new shady business deal. This is a shady business deal that's been going forever.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, if you look at downtown, a lot of those casinos have a lot of very complicated landlords, series of landlords. So yeah, this has been going on for a while. It's kind of neat. And, you know, so if we fast forward to the early 2000s, let's say 2005, 2006 now. So Ramada has sold off all their hotels and has renamed themselves Aztar, which is interesting. They were headquartered in Phoenix. It was supposed to be reminiscent of the Aztec Empire.
Right.
For some reason, although the casino was the Tropicana. So it's kind of interesting. So we have that. Remember, this is when the gaming business was really doing a lot of consolidation, where you have MGM buying up Mandalay Resort Group, eventually buying Mirage. You have Harrah's buying Rio and buying everybody, and then buying Caesars and all that happening. So you have that going on. And, you know, Aztar, it's not really big enough to buy other companies. So suddenly, hey, who wants to buy us? And Pinnacle Gaming, which was a regional casino operator, a lot of riverboats, starts. Colony Capital, which was an investment firm that owned several casinos at the time, including the Hilton, comes in, you know, and they had this bidding war. And then a company named Columbia Sussex that owned two casinos in Lake Tahoe, a small casino, the Westin Casuarina in Vegas, and a couple other casinos, basically buys it. They paid a lot of money for it. And they have suddenly, and Columbia Sussex announces, there's going to be a huge reinvestment here. We are going to add 9,500 new hotel rooms. So basically make it a 10,000 room property. So twice the size of MGM Grand, across the street from MGM Grand, if you can imagine that.
Yeah.
That's the idea, you know, but it's really interesting, too, where the company ran into trouble. No, they didn't get into trouble for that. They got into trouble in Atlantic City. They did a couple things. They sparred with the union, and then they also were maybe a little bit supercilious when they were dealing with the regulators, which regulators don't like. So maybe they lack some humility there. So they ended up getting forced out of that market. They ended up getting bought by a Toronto-based private equity fund who ran it, and then eventually in 2015, it was sold to Penn National Gaming, who then themselves sold it to Bally's in 2022.
Not to be confused with the Bally's that was previously owned by Caesar's Palace.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So Bally's, oh my God, like the corporate history of Bally's. I know originally you have Bally Gaming. Then it's part of it becomes Park Place Entertainment. Then it gets bought, but they divest some properties and they're kind of floating around. Other people buy that. It's interesting how these kind of get passed around. So by the end of it, the people who own the Tropicana Atlantic City didn't own the one in Nevada, and also for the Tropicana or the Bally's in Atlantic City, different owner with Nevada and other states too. So it's kind of interesting how that went. These kept changing hands. So Bally's Las Vegas, which was originally the MGM Grand Las Vegas, and then Bally's Grand Las Vegas, and Bally's, you know, as you know, became the Horseshoe Las Vegas recently.
Not to be confused with the former Binion's Horseshoe.
Yes.
Downtown.
Yeah. So it's kind of fun how they like to move these around, you know, kind of like how the Golden Nugget Atlantic City was originally on the boardwalk there. It then became Bally's Grand, then the Grand of Bally's Casino Resort, then the AC Hilton, then the ACH, then the Atlantic Club. I think, and now it's been closed for over 10 years, I think. And the Golden Nugget Atlantic City, the current Golden Nugget Atlantic City, opened as Trump Castle, then became Trump Marina, and then became Golden Nugget Atlantic City. So the name's kind of passing around.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one-coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5-quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
I did a little bit of digging into the Tropicana as well, and found some facts that I thought were kind of fun and sort of interesting. And I wanted to expound on those a little bit. Sammy Davis Jr. once owned a partial ownership of the Tropicana, which was an absolutely huge deal at the time. How did Sammy become involved in the Tropicana? Where did that come from?
All right. So at the time, you know, and I think probably a lot of your listeners know the history of the Rat Pack. I'll kind of recap it a little bit here just for fun. You know, so basically you have Frank Sinatra, who started playing at the Sands in 1953. Dean Martin starts playing a little bit later, and Sammy Davis starts playing there too. Then in January of 1960, they all get put together by Al Freeman, the Sands PR director, and like, hey, this is going to be the biggest show business of that ever. They're filming Ocean's 11, and it goes over really huge. And for several years, they perform together, never under the name the Rat Pack. Sinatra hated the Rat Pack name, usually just Frank and his friends, something like that, or Dean and his friends. You know, they were kind of moving around. So you had that. You know, then Howard Hughes buys the Sands. Frank Sinatra leaves. He goes to Caesar's Palace. Dean Martin leaves, goes to the Riviera, where he is a part owner. Also, Frank Sinatra had been a part owner of the Sands. You know, so Dean becomes a shareholder at the Riviera, and this is similar. So Sammy gets a small piece of the Tropicana.
And again, as I say, like, it was a huge deal at that time, because Sammy Davis Jr. being African-American, and there was still lots of issues in Vegas at that time with segregation and racism, things like that. This, again, as I say, was a massive deal for him to go in and take ownership.
It was. He was the first Black owner in the Strip, not first Black casino owner or gaming operator, because there were clubs in the West Side and other places too, you know, going back to 1931 that had Black ownership. But definitely, as an investor on the Strip, he was the first.
Siegfried and Roy also have a little bit of history with the Tropicana, which for some reason, I think I knew that in the back of my brain, but until it sort of popped into the forefront as I was doing some reading into this, they made their Vegas debut at the Tropicana.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. And you see that too, where names you don't always associate with the Tropicana, you realize, hey, they did spend some time there. They have a connection.
They were also sort of part of that original Folly show, before moving on to the New Frontier and later on to the Mirage, where of course that was their biggest time in Vegas.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it does say something about the progression of entertainment in Vegas, where back when they had the reviews, you know, you've got dozens of showgirls and costumes. They do although the costumes, sometimes it's just the bottom half and the headdress, you know, not always a shirt, but you know, they still got to get changed. So what are you going to do while they're getting changed? You know, you're not just going to have the house lights go down or the lights on the stage go down. Hey, why not have a comedian or magicians come out? So the magicians start almost as a support for the review. And people are interested in enough that becomes the center of the show. So that's really the evolution there, you know, and then when they start headlining at the Mirage, this was also a huge deal because, oh my God, it's the highest ticket price ever in Vegas. And it's the people who 10 years ago, that would be your support act, you know, while the women are getting changed. So it's kind of interesting how that goes. They flipped it around completely.
The other thing I found interesting too with the Trop was they once had their own golf and country club, which is not really obviously a thing along the strip now, other than the Wynn. They've got a golf course still on the strip, which if I'm recalling correctly, at one point was in danger of going away entirely. But the Sands, I believe they also had a golf course. But yeah, the Tropicana had the golf course right across the street.
It's really interesting. So you had at one point, I'm not going to get all of them, you know, on the strip itself, you had, of course, the Desert Inn, which was the first golf course. You had the Dunes Golf Course, which is where Bellagio City Center is now. You had the Tropicana Golf Course. You also had casinos owning golf courses off the strip. So Stardust had a golf course. Showboat had a golf course at one point. So at one point, everybody, it seemed like everybody owned a golf course at one point. Most of them, again, are off the strip. But at the time, that was the thing. You had your casino. And at some point in the 60s, you built or bought a golf course.
I would imagine that they also realized that when people are out golfing, golf is a very time-consuming game. And that's basically 4 hours where those people are not in a casino pulling slots or sitting at a table.
Yeah, and that's, again, kind of the shift there when they went away from the high-end stuff with, okay, we want fewer high-end people who, yeah, they'll play golf for 4 hours, but then they'll come in and drop a lot of money at the tables, to we want quarter slot machine players who, you know, if they're not sitting in front of that slot machine putting quarters in, you know, there's only so much time they have to do that. So, yeah, that's one of the reasons why they shifted and why golf courses, you know, went out of fashion in Vegas to an extent.
Let's talk about the future, or I guess lack thereof, for the Tropicana. I mean, Major League Baseball rumors sort of started floating around, and I guess it was early 2021, in around there. And of course, the proliferation of professional sports in Las Vegas with the Golden Knights and the Raiders coming to town. There were a few sites that were sort of bantered around for a stadium. The Rio was one I recall reading, or at least Rio adjacent, and then the Wild Wild West, which I seem to recall was actually announced. There was an agreement in principle for the Wild Wild West.
Yeah, this is something that fascinates me. It's just, I don't know if it's a memory hole thing or what, but I'm not going to look it up now, but basically, as I remember it, maybe my memory is the one that's faulty here, they announced a partnership with Station, with Red Rock Resorts. They were going to build it there, and then overnight just said, okay, kick them to the curb, which, I mean, to me, that would set off a whole bunch of red flags. Well, if they did them like that, why would we think that, in addition to leaving Oakland, you know, why would they think they have any loyalty to anybody? So that's kind of interesting that there doesn't seem to be, yeah. I'm glad I'm not the only one who's confused by that.
What are your thoughts on the selection of the Tropicana, of that site, for a baseball stadium? Good, bad, indifferent?
I mean, I guess good for the casinos around it. It'll be a good attraction, probably not so good for traffic, but I mean, maybe it is good that you route everything there, so everything's in one place, you know, as opposed to other places. I don't know. You know, it is a shame to see, after having survived for so long, to see the Tropicana closing.
Is there a real sort of downness amongst the Vegas community about the Tropicana closing? Because it doesn't seem, in what I'm sort of seeing as from the tourist side, from the outside side, it feels like people are more upset about the Mirage Volcano being replaced with a guitar tower for the Hard Rock Hotel than the Tropicana going away. Or maybe it's just, it hasn't really sunk in yet that the Tropicana is going away.
Yeah, I think you've got a good point there, because that volcano is something pretty iconic at this point, where the Tropicana maybe not so iconic, although it's important, very important historically. Very few. So I imagine if you're doing a TV show and you want to do an establishing shot of Vegas, you know, probably a couple of years ago, the volcano would have been one of the big things. I don't think anybody's first establishing shot is going to be the Tropicana. I don't. But, and that's not to say the Tropicana isn't awesome. I've got to tell you, the first time I came to Vegas in 1997, you know, having grown up in Atlantic City, having worked in Atlantic City, I was just blown away by the fact that they had the swim up blackjack. I'm like, oh my God. Because, you know, Atlantic City is so heavily regulated. I'm like, oh my God, how can they do that? They're in the pool. And this is just, and it's like a lush, and again, we get so jaded. I'm like, oh my God, this is like an island paradise here. And wow, I've never seen anything like this in a casino. Because of course, you know, the Atlantic City casinos don't have that level of greenery. So that, I, while you have that happening, of course, there's all this other stuff getting built around it. So maybe people don't appreciate it as much as they might.
I'm not going to lie. I definitely didn't appreciate it as much as I probably could have. My last trip here to Vegas back in February was sort of the first time that I went and actually really walked around the property. I mean, I'd sort of cut past it and gone into it maybe to go grab a bite to eat or something. But I actually took the time to wander around and walk through the pool area and see where the bungalows were. And I'd never, all the years that I've been going to Vegas, I'd never noticed the stained glass ceiling in the entrance, because why am I looking up when I walk in? It wasn't something that popped. So I'll freely admit that I'm one of those people that probably didn't appreciate the Trop as much as I should have.
Yeah. One thing I love about the Tropicana is that it was so quirky in a way that Vegas used to be, mm-hmm. where you don't see that anymore. So for example, the Tropicana had a snake pit, a literal snake pit, because they had, so for a while in the 80s, they're going with this whole island thing, and they had the wildlife walk in the 90s, and basically they had, you know, lizards and snakes and stuff like that. So they literally had a snake pit to keep the snakes and wild birds and stuff like that, which you would never see. I don't think a casino today would do something that quirky, that, I don't even know if the right word is odd, but yeah, like we're going to, you know, Fountain Bluey, let's have some snakes. But again, what did that lead, you know, what also was happening at that time? You had the lion habitat at MGM Grand, you had the white tigers, you know, so it's kind of, to me, that's really interesting. And you're not, I don't know that you're going to see a place that is that unusual where you've got a casino with a snake pit.
No, with all of the de-theming and watering down of so many properties and scaling stuff back. Yeah, I don't see the Fountain Blue putting a snake pit in to, you know, that's not going to bring in the clientele.
Yeah. Well, who knows? But you kind of, like, personally, one really fun thing I did was in 2017. So around the time of the 60th anniversary, I got to write a story for Vegas 7. I got access. So I got to see the snake pit, which was still there, you know, although it was, the snakes were all long gone, but it just kind of, hey, this is a snake pit. And you kind of appreciate that and walk away. It's just cool too. Just a building that's built in stages like that, and the architecture doesn't totally make sense. The geometries are somehow kind of off, but it just feels more personable in a lot of ways than the places that are organized more logically.
Where is or was the snake pit in the Tropicana?
Kind of in one of the bungalow areas, kind of there. So I think it might have been abolished since then. Again, this is now 7 years ago that I saw it. But yeah, that was... Got to see that. Got to see the old catwalks for the surveillance. So that was kind of fun to get in there. And, you know, you do see, I don't know, you almost wish they could build a new casino next to it, then save the old casino and have a tour go through there. Hey, this is what a casino is like. Because it is really cool. We're like, wow.
A marketing idea for the Tropicana folks, if they happen to listen to this, before it gets torn down, do like behind the scenes tours. Come see the snake pit.
Yeah, if the snake pit's even still there. Again, that was a while ago that I saw the snake pit, but you kind of, yeah, you know, when you don't really see that today.
No, again, not many hotels with snake pits being built,
which I think is a loss, you know, because you also had Circus was a big deal, and you had other stuff like that, stuff like the Binion's Horseshoe Million Dollar Display. Every place had these things that were unique to them. And yeah, maybe were a little bit corny in some ways, but was something different, mm-hmm. you know, where today it feels like it's more, you know, delivering an upscale experiential, interactive experience.
And it does seem like they have watered down a lot of the casinos. And I understand that, again, we're not in the 90s and 2000s where we had the high level theme properties going up, or even, as you say, somewhere like the Tropicana that has a cohesive theme per se. But I mean, if you walk through, when I've walked through Resorts World and I've walked through Fountain Blue, I mean, there's no question that these are beautiful properties that they've obviously spent a lot of money on. But walking through Resorts World, to me, I could be walking through a shopping mall in Minneapolis, and it would look, it would have the same level of character in my mind as what some of these other properties have.
Yeah, I think it does lose a lot of the charm. And that's something, it's almost like the limited resources they had back in those days made for, I don't want to say better experience, but just for something, again, a little bit more individualistic, as opposed to when you've got more resources, you can give something that's going to appeal to a lot of people for sure, but it's not going to be quite as distinctive.
David, thank you for jumping on and chatting today. I really do appreciate it. And I always love having you on to pick your brain and talk Vegas history. It's always a blast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I love it too.
And that wraps up another episode of Jeff Does Vegas. If you've got feedback on this episode of the show, or any other episode for that matter, or you've got suggestions and ideas for topics you'd like me to cover on the podcast, please feel free to reach out via social media on Facebook, X, or Instagram at Jeff Does Vegas. You can also email me directly at jeff@jeffdoesvegas.com. In the meantime, thanks for checking out the show. Be sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts so you'll be notified the instant a new episode is released. While you're there, go ahead and rate us and write a review. And don't forget to visit jeffdoesvegas.com for past episodes, show notes, Vegas deals, and more. My name is Jeff, and this has been Jeff Does Vegas, a Walker New Media production.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.